So I am delighted to be here tonight and this weekend. It's true, when Rodney was speaking in the beginning, my motivation for coming, of course, is my deep friendship with Rodney and our creative bond. And as well, I really appreciate the Sangha. Every time I come, I'm quite moved by the earnestness and sincerity that I experience. So I appreciate this a lot. What I would like to speak about this evening is wise speech. And I thought it would be an interesting topic. I mean, I'm not going to allude or talk about politics or the economic situation or any of these kinds of things. But I... Can you hear? You can't hear me. Okay. I think I'll just try to talk louder, see how that goes. So I just thought it would be an interesting exploration to reflect on wise speech tonight. Can you hear me now? Not that good. Not that... Can it be cranked up a little bit? Or is it at the maximum? It's at the maximum. All right. Next time I'm going to wear a turtleneck. Hey. I know. Okay. So, I'd like to begin by reading you something, and just to say that it uses the word Avalokiteshvara, and Avalokiteshvara is the personification of compassion. So when you hear this, this is what this means. It's kind of evoking compassion. We evoke your name, Avalokiteshvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering in the world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We evoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what has been left unsaid. We know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering. Bringing our attention to the exploration of why speech does imply listening. Now, when we think about speech, of course, we think about what's coming out of our mouths. But to be aware of our speech does require a depth of listening. Not just to what's coming out of our mouths, but also to the inner dialogue. Being alert and sensitive to how we speak to ourselves, to the tone of voice that we use in speaking to ourselves. Being aware of the ways in our minds, not what's actually coming out of our mouth, but what's going on in our minds regarding the ways that we speak to others. I think this area of wise speech is an incredibly rich arena. And it isn't easy. My attention was brought to this arena after my first long retreat. I sat a 3-month retreat when I first began to practice. And a lot of the time I was listening to what I had said before the retreat or what I was planning to say after the retreat. And I'll tell you, I was absolutely appalled by what I had said, absolutely appalled by what I had said, and even more appalled by what I was planning to say when I got out of the retreat. And I had heard about a yogi somewhere, I think maybe on the West Coast, actually, Baba Haridas, who has a little blackboard and a piece of chalk, and he has taken a vow of silence. So, as far as I know, he doesn't talk at all. He has this little blackboard, and of course, the description is that it's a fairly small blackboard. So, he just writes his answers or responds through in a very short way. And I thought about Hari Baba Das, and I thought, you know, that's it. I'm never talking again. Huh? Before I left the retreat, I was thinking, forget it. There's no way I can trust myself to say one more word. And I was thinking about him in an envious way. You know, I was about to go and invest in a little blackboard. And then I realized that it's not really my nature. I was probably going to have to talk when I left. And so I became really interested in how to bring the practice to speech. Someone said, a Zen master, open your mouth and you're wrong. Yeah? Open your mouth and you're wrong. In other words, we're always a little bit off. And yet, of course, we want to communicate with one another. And we need to communicate with one another. But I think this is a practice that is wonderful for beginning yogis, beginning practitioners right off the bat, as well as for much older, experienced practitioners. Now, it seems to be an arena that is endlessly rich if we're willing to be aware. And as with any practice, of course, patience is required in the practice of wise speech. Interest is required. Dedication and compassion are required. And as I was alluding to before, being able to tolerate discomfort is required as well. You kind of have to have a strong stomach to be able to tolerate yourself and be able to encourage yourself to actually be aware of speech as it's happening. So what we're interested in, I think, is the difference between investigation and condemnation, because this area in life is not easy. The instructions, of course, in our practice are to bring awareness to every area of our life. You know, whatever area we don't bring the practice to is where there's going to be a problem. So to bring attention to every area in our life. And it is true that there are a whole lot other easier areas than wise speech. You know, it is much easier to be aware of brushing your teeth with attention than it is to be aware of speech. And yet, so much suffering happens because of the ways that we are unconscious when we speak. Wise speech, of course, is one of the path factors. And the Buddha only had 8. So you can see that the Buddha valued this enormously, to give it 1 whole path factor out of 8. As a path factor, there are 2 aspects to it. One aspect is that bringing our attention to speech, looking at what is wise and what might not be, includes being aware of speech as a guide for our actions. In other words, you could see that speech is a way of acting. And so harmful speech is going to bring harm and cause suffering, and kind speech is going to contribute to kindness in this world. So that's one aspect. But the other has to do with the fact that it's an aid in seeing the mind. It's a way for us to see our mind. Sometimes it's a little bit of a complex tangle in there. And we don't really know what's going on. We can see what's going on simply by observing our thoughts being expressed through speech. So as an investigation, really what's involved is listening to ourselves. Speech really is a reflection of the mind. When we notice and are aware of our habitual ways of speaking, we can begin to be aware as well of our intentions, of our mental states, of our emotions. For example, you know, sometimes we don't even know how we're feeling, and something very strong is coming out of us. We may not know how angry we are, and yet, in observing our speech, angry words, an angry tone of voice is occurring. This is really helpful information. Awareness of speech helps us to see our minds. Now, it's definitely not to identify with what we hear ourselves saying, because we're really sunk if we are identifying with what we're saying. It's not that I am my speech, you are your speech. Now, it's not because we may see anger or whatever it might be, it doesn't translate into I am an angry person in a lasting, continuous, fundamental way. And so we really want to see this as information, not in any kind of rigid or tight way. The point is to see the gap between the ideals that we may have of living in a peaceful way and contributing peace in this world and the actuality of things. When we find ourselves propelled into speech by our emotions, by our emotional state. Because if we can look in this way, we can see that although speech is an expression of the gap between our ideals and the actuality of things, at the same time, it can as well be a vehicle of freedom. What we don't know is oppressive. What we do know is freeing. And change can come about through being awake and mindful. So we're going through a process of shifting out of that which is deeply, oftentimes deeply mechanical, to being conscious. We are shifting out of the habitual to awareness. We're moving, shifting from speaking in a reflexive, habitual way to a wise response. And we're moving from reactivity towards wisdom and compassion. I think it's important to stress that in no way are we trying for perfection. Now, if you hear this what this Zen master said, open your mouth and you're wrong, we're not trying to be perfect speakers. It's not possible. You know? When we speak, it's here and then it's gone. And obviously, our words can have a huge effect on ourselves and others. But in another way of looking at it, they don't have as much substance as they appear to. So we're not trying for perfection, to be perfect, to be perfect speakers, to learn how to be always wise in our speech, but instead to look in a fresh way, to see if we can be aware of the themes that come up over and over again. We may have a sense of these themes when we're silent and we're watching our minds. But to be aware of these themes when we're in contact with others and when we're actually talking, to be aware of the tone of voice, you know, mindful of the tone of the voice that we're using, aware of the kinds of vocabulary that we use in an habitual way. So working with speech in this way can be a way to shed light on a complex inner network, which is known as our conditioning. Yeah. It's really kind of where it can help to see, to look into the family that we grew up in, to take a look at the ways that we learned how to speak early on. You know, for me, in my family, people said, "I love you," through being intensely sarcastic. You know? That's how people said that they loved you. You knew they loved you if they were being sarcastic to you. You know, if they were ignoring you, then it was a problem. So when I got older and I started making friends and was out on my own, I continued with that pattern. You know, people that I really, really liked, that I really loved, I would be sarcastic with. Now, they did not grow up in my family. So, of course, there was a bit of a different reaction. And I had to learn to actually say, "I love you," instead of thinking that the sarcasm was going to do the whole thing. But to look at the family background in this way, I think, is really important because we learn these things. We have learned how to speak in certain ways, and we can learn something different. To say a little bit about wise speech, and I want to talk about unwise speech as well this evening, but to just say a little bit about wise speech, perhaps to look at why we speak. You know, what are the reasons that we might want to speak instead of not speaking? And those reasons, of course, are to unify one person with another or one group with another. You know, we might want to speak to be encouraging, to awaken, to guide, to inspire. As we know, words can be enormously healing and enormously helpful. Words as well can be enormously wounding and harmful. But when they are inspiring, it can have such a huge effect. I just was listening to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech that I'm sure all of us hear from time to time, or at least little parts of it. And so enormously powerful. Every time one hears those words, the heart is moved in some way. For most of us, this is what happens. There's a sense of feeling that we can be in this world in a different way, in a less separate way, in a way that is truly benign. So we can use words to challenge injustice, you know, to really speak the truth. It can be courageous to speak at times, to say that which is truthful. We speak because of the sake of intimacy of other at other times, to clarify. Sometimes we speak to transmit information, so it's informational, which is another reason for speaking. We can speak to console and to support. We can speak out of affection. You know, an affectionate word, sometimes well-placed, makes a big impact in someone else's life. I know in Cambridge at CIMC, you know, we give Dharma talks and we teach and we do this and that. And so often, someone will come to the center and they'll go into the office and ask a very simple question about when a retreat is happening, or can they have an interview with one of us, or something along those lines. And someone in the office, we have four people on staff in our office. And everyone there is devoted to kindness and speaking with tenderness. And so sometimes these are the best experiences that practitioners have in the center, is when they're going in not particularly to hear the Dharma, but to find out something very simple about how the center works. Someone speaking to them in the office with such kindness makes them feel that they can come back, that they don't have to be intimidated, that they're being held with kindness. And I've always seen this make a huge difference. We speak because of appreciation. As Shantideva in the Bodhisattva Way of Life said, "Praise all who speak the truth and say, 'Your words are excellent.' And when you notice others acting well, encourage them in terms of warm approval. Praise all who speak the truth and say, 'Your words are excellent.' And when you notice others acting well, encourage them in terms of warm approval." You know, we can use words to appreciate one another. And this is enormously supportive in a life. We use words for the sake of compassion. And it's deeply meaningful. In terms of wise speech, the Buddha said to say the right thing at the right time, in the right place, to the right person. So to say the right thing actually doesn't mean right or wrong. It means to say the wise thing. And the wise thing means a wise intention. It means to speak the truth. It means in terms of content. Know what is the wise thing to say. And this is something that is an arena of inquiry. What is the wise thing to say? And then the second instruction, to say the right thing at the right time. You know? So one example of this might be when it can be heard. You know? Because we might notice that we have something that really needs to be said, and yet we're saying it at such a time as to make the other person defensive in some way, or saying it at such a time where maybe the other person is tired or fatigued and can't really hear it. Maybe there is a time pressure happening, and so sometimes to say the right thing at the right time means choosing our time with wisdom, so that there's enough space, there's enough time to really go into that which might be difficult to say. And also, the right time might be, if we're upset, after we've calmed down some, so that we're not speaking under the sway of emotion. We're not speaking because of the pressure that it's so easy to speak out of, the pressure of the difficult emotions, you know, but to encourage ourselves to wait when we feel that pressure, unless something absolutely has to be said. You know, when we feel that pressure, it always feels like what we need to say absolutely has to be said, and there's no other time to say it. But of course, you know, when we're willing to bring more attention to that pressure, we can see that oftentimes that pressure comes and goes. And what comes out when we're under that sense of pressure is somewhat hit or miss. You know, might be exactly what needs to be said, and very much may not be as well. So to say the right thing at the right time, in the right place. In the right place might be trying to establish safety, if that's possible. In the right place might be speaking to someone one-on-one instead of in a crowd. These are just possibilities that I'm throwing out. Saying the right thing at the right time, in the right place, to the right person. Now, so to the right person means to speak to the person that we're upset with. Sometimes when we're quite upset, we really express that upsetness, we get irritated at the person that we're not actually irritated with. You know, we're transferring it. So to the right person means to the person that we need to speak to. Sometimes when we find ourselves in distress and we don't know what to do, we also find ourselves going from one person to another person to another person, trying to find the right way to be, whereas oftentimes it's quite beneficial to see if we can be quiet and observe what's happening until wisdom emerges in a more organic and natural way. And as well as George Sala said, not only to say the right thing in the right place, but far more difficult to leave unsaid the wrong thing at the tempting moment. You know, much harder, usually, than the other. So the practice of wise speech is to be aware of intention. Now, if we're going to take this on as a practice, it means, first of all, seeing if we can be aware of intention before we actually speak. Because sometimes we can catch our intention, it's very clear, it's very lucid. Other times we are in the midst of something and we don't even know why we're speaking. You know, so to see if we can catch intention. And then to be aware of speech itself as it's happening, which of course includes our facial expressions as well. We can roll our eyes, we can say a whole lot of different things without saying anything, you know, through our body language. So of course it includes body language as well. So aware of intention, aware of speaking itself, which is an interesting practice because to be aware of speech, you have to be in your body. Because speech is coming from your body. It's a physical experience. You know? It's, of course, happening because of the mind, but you can feel it in your body. So some way of grounding yourself in your body as you speak. You know? And then seeing if one can be aware, and it's, you know, you have to take this on in a kind of a very spacious way rather than a heavy way. Because when we practice this, it seems like there's a lot to be aware of, and it's way too much. But as we practice it, it gets easier, it gets more fluid. We become more sensitized to the habitual ways that we speak. So to ground oneself in one's body, and then to be aware of where you feel speech happening in your body physically. Know, as well. So being aware of speaking and then being aware after having spoken and then, and this is pretty crucial, letting go. Yeah. Because how many times have we said something and then have thought about what we've said over and over and over and over again? We've said it once. You know, who knows if it's actually had the effect that we assume it's had? You know, maybe yes, oftentimes no. But inwardly, we're repeating the same thing that we've said. I mean, you'd think it would be boring at some point, but it doesn't tend to be. Every time it seems to be quite, you know, fresh to us and agonizing to us. Or if we've said something that we've enjoyed saying, pleasurable to us. That pleasure doesn't seem to wear off, you know? But it's very, very important to notice what is being highlighted. You know, what we're repeating inwardly, even though it's already over. It's been over a long time ago. You know, to notice that repetition. So aware of intention, aware of speaking, aware after having spoken, and then letting go. Being aware of the mind, of course, as well. Is our speech being fueled by the afflictive emotions by the torments of heart? Or is our speech being propelled, fueled by loving kindness, or by clarity, or by generosity? And we can ask ourselves, is it true? Is it kind? Is it beneficial? Does it harm anyone? Is it the right time? To say a little bit about common habits that the Buddha advised letting go of. When I speak about this, you might notice that some of these habits you don't have at all. So you can hear about one of these habits and you can think, well, that definitely isn't a problem for me, because it isn't. And then you may hear about another habit that the Buddha spoke about and you may think, yes, you know, this is definitely an arena that bears looking at. Because these things are different for different people. You know, some of us we all have a different set of habits according to our conditioning. You know, I teach in Cambridge, I teach classes on wise speech from time to time, and I always do talk about these particular habits. There are four specific ones. And I always find it quite interesting as the class moves along, because maybe one quarter, you know, kind of really connects with the first one, and then another quarter of the class, the second one, and then by the third week, you know, another quarter. And then the last week, people will think, well, I'm in the clear, you know, no problem. And then that last one is the one that they find that they have difficulty with. So it's just different for different people. The first has to do with untruthful speech. When we speak that which is true, and it doesn't have to be truth, just whatever is true, the mind is quieter. And we notice this for ourselves. There is a greater degree of simplicity instead of complexity in our lives. There's more confidence. We have more confidence in ourselves. And there's a lack of pretense and a greater sense of ease. And we notice that people trust us more. We trust ourselves more when we speak the truth. And people trust us more as well. We trust and respect ourselves. And life is a whole lot less complicated because we have to remember our lies. And as we get older, you know, this gets harder and harder. But I remember when I was growing up, I have two sisters, and when we were all in high school at the same time, we wanted to do things. We wanted to go out and do all sorts of things. And my parents were concerned about our physical well-being, understandably. And so they had different ideas about what we should be doing and what we wanted to do. My mother actually said that she always wanted us girls to be freer than her, but she never thought we'd carry it so far. So we had a difference of opinion. And in order to do what we wanted to do, we started concocting lies. But the problem was that we all had to support the other person's lies. So you didn't just have to remember your own pretty complicated lie. You also had to remember two other people's complicated lies. So what a tangled web we were leading. And at a certain point, we realized that it was no longer necessary to lie, but it had become a habit. You know, because we had been doing it for a good 4 years, when we got out of the house, and of course we were on our own and there was no reason to lie, because we had been practicing it, we realized that we had to stop practicing it and train ourselves in a different way. know? And when we see one of these patterns, this is exactly what has to happen, is that we have to retrain ourselves, you know? Try to stop practicing that which is unwholesome, not whole, fragmented. See if we can practice something different. But this, it was a bit of a process, and when I left high school, I was in college for a little bit. And my first year of college, I was at a school where there was a big Jewish population. Now, my mother is Irish Catholic, and my father is Russian Jewish, so I have both. In this school, the Jewish holidays were, you still had to go to school during the Jewish holidays. I'm talking about the story because of Rosh Hashanah. But if you were Jewish, of course, you could take the day off. Now, I was brought up Catholic, you know? I was brought up Catholic, so there really wouldn't be a reason for me to take the day off. But because I was still in this habit, you know, this habit energy from high school, I thought, well, I could take the day off, and I have a Jewish last name, and I'll just say that it's because of the Jewish holidays. So I did that. I took the day off, and then I went back to school the next day, and my professor asked me why I hadn't been there. And I said, I had to be away because of Rosh Hosanna. No. In other words, I had only read this word. No one was talking about Rosh Hashanah, but I saw that it was spelled Rosh Hosanna. So everyone was looking at me quite puzzled. And I don't know what they thought, actually. And it took a little while after that to realize that it was Rosh Hashanah. So I got really caught in this big lie. But the point is that whatever we practice, that's what we have to unpractice. If we see something, then we have to start training ourselves in a different direction. Because when we are not telling the truth, there is a lack of intimacy. It is actually separating. It separates us from ourselves, and it certainly separates us from others. It fosters confusion. You know, one of the real downsides of not telling the truth is that we get other people confused. It's perhaps not our intention. You know, perhaps our intention seems to be survival or whatever it might be. We need to look at what our intention is. But what actually happens is we confuse others. Others get confused. And it's certainly the opposite of clarity. When we are devoted to telling the truth, we find that we can breathe more easily. You know, it's kind of like when we first hear the Dharma, when we first come to the teachings. I don't know how many of you are totally new, but I know that many of us, when we first hear the Dharma, and the Dharma means, one meaning of the Dharma is the truth of things, there's like a sigh of relief that we're finally hearing the truth, you know? There's a sense of ease and of spaciousness because we know we're hearing the truth. You know, so this is something that we can offer ourselves and others. Now, the guideline that the Buddha encouraged is to speak in a way that is both truthful as well as useful. Now, so sometimes we think we're speaking the truth when it's just an opinion, a tightly held opinion. You know, I hate your dress is an opinion. You know, it may be the truth, but it doesn't really much matter. So looking at the difference between opinion and what might be truthful and useful as well. The second habit that the Buddha encouraged us to let go of is divisive speech. But just to say a little bit more about truthful speech, I wanted to also say one wants to connect truthful speech with kind speech, not indulging in the truth. Something Alice Miller said, if it's painful for you to criticize, you're safe. If there is the slightest pleasure in criticizing, better to hold back. Yeah? She said it, she said it in a more elegant way. If it's very painful for you to criticize your friends, you're safe in doing it. But if you take the slightest pleasure in it, that's the time to not. You know, just as a bit of a guide, you know, to criticize, to look at the pleasure element in it as well. So to move to the second aspect, the second habit that the Buddha suggested that we drop, this has to do with speech that is divisive, that divides. The other positive element of this, of course, is when we let go of divisive speech, we are practicing unifying speech, bringing people together. And this is seen as so important that it's one of the major monk rules. You know, monks, of course, have many, many different rules. And a lot of them are just, if you break them, it's not a huge thing. There are a few where it's really a big thing. And one of the rules that really is a big thing is when there is the intent to be divisive in a sangha, you know, to divide one part of a sangha from the other part of the sangha. To be aware of our intention when we're being divisive, because oftentimes it comes out of resentment that has not been, that we are not aware of, that we need to pay more attention to, or the desire for pleasure. Now, but that pleasure is so superficial, it really doesn't last. I don't know if you've ever had the experience of talking in a very divisive way and then being afraid that it's going to get back to the person that you spoke about. You know, and that pleasure so easily turns into pain. There is said to be a karmic result of speaking in a non-divisive way. And that karmic result is that people will not easily believe slander about you. You know, when things are said that are unkind about you, it will not be believed as easily. Oftentimes, there is a desire for intimacy, and it can be emotionally bonding. But the problem is that we lose a sense of intimacy with ourselves. And a lot of this comes out of not having learned how to work with conflict skillfully. And so this is something that we can train ourselves in. This is something that we can actually learn. One of my teachers in Thailand, a teacher named Thon Panya, when I practiced with him many years ago in my very early years of practice, he gave me this wonderful piece of advice. He said, when something difficult has to be said, say it yourself. Don't get somebody else to say it. You know, don't try to avoid saying it because of fear or because you think you can't do it. Just see if you can do it anyway as a training. Don't avoid the difficult. And we find it was such a great piece of advice because I took it seriously and I started working with that. And I found, as I'm sure some of you here have found, that it's a skill, that you have to do it in order to learn it. One can't just think it's a good idea. We have to practice with one another. Because if we practice with one another, we find that it is a skill that we actually can learn, non-avoidance of the difficult, learning to work skillfully with conflict. There is a Tibetan proverb, which is, it is easier to see an ant on one's neighbor's nose than a yak on one's own. It is easier to see an ant on our neighbor's nose than a yak on one's own. Because it can be a habit to find fault. And I'd like to read you something, a Rumi poem. Four Indians enter a mosque and begin the prostrations, deep, sincere praying. But a priest walks by, and one of the Indians, without thinking, says, "Oh, are you going to give the call to prayers now? Is it time?" The second Indian, under his breath, "You spoke. Now your prayers are invalid." The third, "Uncle, don't scold him. You've done the same thing. Correct yourself." The fourth, also out loud, "Praise to God, I haven't made the mistake of these three." So all four prayers are interrupted, with the three fault finders more at fault than the original speaker. Blessed is one who sees his weakness, and blessed is one who, when he sees a flaw in someone else, takes responsibility for it, because half of any person is wrong and weak and off the path. Half, the other half, is dancing and swimming and flying in the invisible joy. The third of the habits that the Buddha encouraged and advised us to drop is unkind speech. So looking at the ways that we speak to one another and to ourselves as well that are unkind, aware of harshness. Sometimes with unkind speech, we just do not know that we're doing it because we're so behind it and it seems so justified. It seems so obviously appropriate. But to investigate this means to be aware of the tone of the voice, to be aware of the vocabulary that we're using, to look at habits such as sarcasm, to be aware of aversion, of impatience, of self-righteousness, to be aware that so often the self is central stage and is taking precedence over anything and anyone else. It isn't easy to see this in oneself because, as I said, it's easy to justify. And oftentimes harsh speech comes out of anxiety. It comes out of a sense of powerlessness and of helplessness. I think that if anyone offers us this kind of information about ourselves, we really need to take it seriously because it is really difficult to see in ourselves. Oftentimes, I have found that this habit comes out of a trauma background, comes out of having been hurt deeply in one's past. And so the speaking harshly is really a way to try to survive. It's just not necessary any longer. But if we get this kind of information to me because it's hard to see in oneself, to take it seriously and to begin to see what's the tone, what's the real intention. Maybe the intention is to protect in some way, and yet it's coming out in a way that is attacking and harmful. So cultivating patience and empathy. Something Aldous Huxley said, that most of religion, most of practice, has to do with learning to be kinder. This, of course, doesn't mean using indirect speech. There was an anesthesiologist that I read about some time ago who inadvertently applied too much anesthesia and the patient died. The hospital, in trying to work with the family about what happened, called this death a therapeutic misadventure. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of wild, and it would be quite hurtful. The military oftentimes calls killing servicing the target. Yeah? And of course, whenever we talk about limited or winnable nuclear war, this is indirect speech as well, to put it mildly. Willa Cather said, when kindness has left people, even for a few moments, we become afraid of them as if their reason has left them. Now, someone perhaps that we have experienced kindness from, maybe many, many, many moments of kindness, then all of a sudden something has happened and there's a harshness that's there. We tend to, I think this is so appropriate, fear arises. We tend to be afraid, even though that person who is speaking may not have that intention, would not want to be a person that anyone needs to fear. And the last, the fourth of the habits, has to do with disconnected speech or speech that is agitated, agitating. And I think the question here is, what's behind the words that we're saying? What's underneath the words? Do we speak in an effort to alleviate boredom or to alleviate our fear or our loneliness or our restlessness? And if we find that this is true, is there another way? Now, just to look, is there another way? Because it can be quite exhausting to both the speaker and the listener when we're speaking in a disconnected way. And in this arena of speech, it to some degree has to do with looking at our habits. You know, is there the habit of complaining or of giving advice or of rushing in to, quote, save others from silence? Now, this habit doesn't have to do with the content. In other words, we can say something that is not enormously meaningful, and yet it is connecting. You know? Because if we see that speech is a way to connect and we talked to connect, we can talk about the weather and it can be connecting. You know? So it's not necessarily what we're talking about, because it depends on who we're talking with and what's required and what's appropriate and what's wise and what's compassionate. But it's looking at the intention. Where is it coming from? Why are we talking? So being aware of these areas of investigation, being aware of listening, being aware of our intention, and being aware of the effect that it has on ourselves and others. And I just would like to end by reading what I read in the beginning one more time. We evoke your name, Avalokiteshvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve the suffering in the world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We evoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen without judging or reacting. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we will be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what has been left unsaid. We know that just by listening deeply, we already alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering. Okay, thank you. All right, so we have a little bit of time if there are any questions. anything you'd like to investigate further regarding anything that I said or interest in your own patterns of speech, whatever you want to ask about. Yeah.
I was in a scenario yesterday with the day before. I was in my car and I came upon somebody else in their car and he had a little bit of road rage and said some incredibly foul and cruel things to me. And it wasn't my response in the moment of what I said back to him. It was all the things 5 minutes later that I had said back to him.
That you should have said.
Yes.
Right.
And just trying to sit with that was incredibly difficult.
Yes.
And like I could feel in myself why people pick up weapons. You know, it was just that.
You knew that.
And
right.
Trying to kind of find the most skillful means in that moment,
mm-hmm.
and what to do with those words in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I appreciate the restraint in the moment. I mean, even though you might feel like you missed your chance, the restraint is a really good thing. I'm so aware these days. I've had two recent situations where people have told me exactly the same situation, but it's gone a little bit further than what you're speaking about. And obviously, you know, it's so dangerous. Because if you had said something, what could come back? You have no idea what kind of energies that that you're unleashing. So the restraint, even though maybe afterwards you wish you weren't, still hopefully you get to a place where you're really happy that there was that restraint. Also, just picking up on what you said about understanding why people might pick up a weapon. That kind of understanding, I think, is really important for us to have, because to really be able to see how easy it is to get caught in a really difficult emotion, and the power of anger, how it pushes us into doing things that we regret at some point, we regret later. It's that sense of empathy, I think, is really important. And then also understanding the value of restraint, because then you can communicate with others better about that kind of thing. In terms of it being so painful afterwards, this is what we sit with. This is it. It can be helpful to remember that it's not permanent, and that it is an opportunity to see how strong the emotion is, and then to see what's happening in terms of the specific thoughts that are there. And it can be helpful just for a moment or two to just stop and notice the thoughts in a very specific way, as in having a thought that I wish you'd drop dead, having a thought that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, whatever they are, because then playing it back to oneself in this way, it becomes crystal clear what is actually happening. And then if we do that enough, oftentimes it's a way to kind of take the charge out of it, take the poison out of it, and begin to see the cost to one's heart. Because we get involved and we get propelled, we get pushed along because we don't really, we think that it has to be that way, and we don't really see sometimes the cost to our hearts. And that has to come in its own way, and usually it's quite gradual when something strong has happened. So it takes courage and it takes determination to sit still. Even if you're, still driving, you're sitting still. But dedicating yourself to not doing anything other than observing this huge tidal wave until it ebbs away. Because if we do that, more and more we have faith in the ebbing, not just in the wave coming, but we also have more faith in the fact that it's going to change. Yeah? Okay. Yeah.
So, as far as my speech, in situations of being in a workplace,
yeah,
it feels sometimes difficult to, if some false speech has been spoken on my part.
So, say that last line again.
False speech has been spoken on my part.
Okay, yeah.
Sometimes I question whether or not it's the best thing to perhaps speak truthfully of that for risk of the effects in the workplace. So when do you advise full disclosure, or what? You know what I mean?
Yes, yes. Is it more like omission, or is it more like omission?
To some degree, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because there's not any, you really have to look at what the intention is there, and there's not any rigid recipe or one way that things have to go. I think it's more a matter of noticing, is there a sense of feeling fragmented? Is there a sense of inauthenticity? Is there a sense of lack of integration? You know, these kinds of things, I think, are the most important thing to see. Because you can try, you know, you can kind of work the edge of this and check that out, see what happens when you do. But, of course, when it comes to not saying something, it depends. There's not one way to go with that, you know? I mean, one is allowed to have a private life, and that is very, very different than a secretive life. So you have to see what that means for you. What is the difference between privacy and secrecy? Okay? Those are just some hints to look at. Yeah. Could you talk louder?
Yes. Occasionally, I find myself in a group of people who share divisive and kind speech.
Right? Yeah.
And I find myself pulled away and wonder how to behave without shaming the other.
Yes. Right. No. This is something that we all have to. We all find ourselves in situations like this from time to time, and it's important to be able to be there and participate, but not, of course, move into a sense of separation, or, and I know you're not moving into this, but a holier than thou kind of thing, right? And oftentimes work situations are situations where this is strongest. I don't know if that's true for you. Does it come up in different situations or mostly at work?
I'm thinking of a couple other places,
social situations. Yeah, right. Because sometimes social situations, there's a way if it's friends. And because work relationships are different, but if you're with friends, and if this comes up with practitioners and you have a similar vocabulary, you can, there's nothing magic, you know, that you can say, but you can experiment with different ways of shaping the conversation or asking a question every so often that might wake people up. You know, and might bring a little bit of a different response back so that it's inquiring rather than coming down on anybody. or coming down on the group, or, you know, kind of splitting the group apart in any way. But just a well-placed question sometimes can be a way to work with that kind of thing. Yeah. Work friendships or work relationships are different in that way, because you have to be with them every day. You know, most people at work, you're with your work partners every day. And so, and, you know, everybody's different in terms of what they're interested in. And so you certainly don't want to impose anything. And I think sometimes to limit the contact is the most skillful thing to do, to see what that looks like. You know, not to avoid, but to limit the contact can sometimes be a skillful way to move. And then maybe something creative comes up, and then you can engage again. You know, maybe you can see that there's something that you haven't discovered yet, and then you can try that out. Okay. Okay. Yeah.
It's been kind of interesting to me to notice that when you eliminate from your conversation talking about a third party who's not there, there's not a lot to talk about.
This is true. No, it's true. It's true. I don't know if you know this about Joseph Goldstein, but he... early on, when he first started practicing, he decided to do this for a little while, and he didn't have much to say. That's what he discovered. Yeah, now you remember that story. Yeah. I think it's how we talk about others. I don't think that never talking about others is a particularly lively way to go about life, because we're social beings, and we learn a lot in talking about others. There is something that can be learned. It's just how, you know, and it's being aware of intention. Is the intention to learn, you know, or is it something else? And I think you can bring your attention to that, and it is possible to talk about others in an investigative kind of way. As long as you remember that whomever you're talking about has Buddha nature. You know, you miss that one and you're kind of sunk. Then you're really lost. But if there's that knowing, that remembering of Buddha nature, then it can be sometimes helpful depending. You don't want to talk about somebody that you're having difficulty with to somebody who... you know, might also be having a big problem with that person at the time. You know? Or if you do, you want to make sure that neither one of you are getting revved up and that it's really fruitful, really useful. Yeah. Okay. Boy, is it hot in here. Is everybody hot? Everybody's hot. Rodney told me it was just me. All right. So, I don't know. Maybe we should call it a night? Yeah? Okay. So let's sit for a moment together.